switching days is weirding me out because now nobody Slack messages me on a Sunday, but I am continuously Slack messaged on the weekdays at 4:25 p.m., which it currently is.
Well, I mean, it's 1:25 in any reasonable place.
It just feels different. I don't know. It's a different vibe. It's like midweek, so I'm like in the thick of things.
Right. Yeah. Like right when we've been on this call for like half an hour already. Because I think as soon as we hopped on, it was just like both of us had a bunch of other messages pop up.
Yeah, that and got a couple of Sentry emails. Got a.
I resolved an email from them right before we hopped on the call.
So one fun thing that I'm doing now on most days is explaining how queues work and how Sidekick works to my coworkers. It's no fault of theirs, you know. So one of our coworkers, he kind of goes around, he's like the rep to different stores, and so he goes to stores and helps them onboard in person. And he's always, you know, we have some things where they drop kind of some legacy data on, so that way they can pull over some customers that have purchased from them physically. And I have, you know, of course I have all that tied to Sidekick jobs. And normally it drains pretty quick. So he might shoot me a message, say, hey, let's double check on the number that was imported, make sure everything was happening fine. And today was a big day because we just added inventory digest emails. So it either sends out an email to the source customers with the latest, you know, the few latest products saying, hey, check out these new products, or to send out like a random email with like random products from a store. And so those went out, which filled up my queues. And then he started importing some of those things, which stacked on the queues. And he's very impatient. He was like, I need to know when they're done. It's like, hey man, you got to wait in line like everyone else around here.
Yeah. You mentioned explaining queues to people. And it just reminded me of this story. I've probably told you this before, but I don't know if I've ever mentioned it on the show. Apparently like shortly after Netflix originally launched, they're big on, you know, you would have back when they actually sent you DVDs, you would have a queue of DVDs that were the next ones you were going to receive. After you sent the ones you currently had back through the mail. We had to send DVDs through the mail, first of all, which seems just wild at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently, for a while after they initially introduced the queues and people were starting to use Netflix, one of the most common questions they got was people would call up and they would say, hey, I don't know, what's a Quayway? I don't know what a Quayway is. What it says that I have to add things to my Quayway. And I'm not sure, I just don't know what to do with that. So you're not the first to have to explain a queue.
Quayway. I don't think I ever used Netflix back then. I only started using it when it was cool and you could stream things. But it's just funny because I think we were talking about this earlier too, like how much I assume people know about computers and how much I assume how they use their computers. And I'm realizing that how I assume people use their computers is not how they use their computers at all. And we were talking about, specifically, I guess, Hotjar. Actually, someone was talking about this earlier today in the Slack channel, too. They're talking about like heat maps and things like that. And I've been using a service called Hotjar, and they provide heat map overlays of pages. So you can say, hey, watch this page for 2,000 sessions, and then show me where people click or scroll or whatever. But they also have a service called, basically, it just records user sessions. And so you can go in and watch them. And it hurts almost to like go and watch them in the sessions because like, not that I don't want to feel elitist. Like I know how to use computers better than other people, but they just use them differently. And it's stressful for me to watch.
Yeah. You've been kind of talking to me a little bit about Hotjar, and I should really get this implemented on Nest Notes, but I'm a little scared at the same time because it's always so, so weird to watch people interact with something that you're so close to.
Yeah, it is. And then I know it's kind of like a pride thing, and I know it's good for me to look at some of that stuff, especially if I'm finding bugs or something like that. But it was super beneficial in the first couple of days because I would look at things and think to myself, oh wow, like the links on this toolbar the hit radius should be way higher because people will try to click on links, but they might miss by a couple of pixels and they don't necessarily realize that they didn't. You know, I'm assuming people are used to AJAX sites now where parts of the page just refresh and they don't see a whole page refresh. And so they might try to click on a link and they actually miss it, but nothing happens. And so they sit for a few seconds waiting for something to happen. And I noticed on a number of sessions that was happening where people were sitting and waiting after missing links.
Yeah, that one in particular, I always find very interesting because especially when you're doing like over the shoulder testing, people seem to like get angry, not even at the site, but kind of at themselves. And I think that sort of thing is super important to take note of when your app is making people unhappy with themselves. Because if that's happening, there's a clear thing that you can fix and improve.
Right. Yeah. Just, you know, it's a simple thing, like something that simple. All I have to do is slap some padding on a link and we're good to go. You know, it's just interesting. Like I always assume I watch my cursor. And so when it changes from the arrow to the pointer, I know that's, you know, hovering over something you can click on, but people don't realize that it changes when you're hovering over a link. And I also realize that people will click on any picture. Doesn't matter where the picture is on the page, they'll click on it, because I think people are used to light boxes or zoom effects or something like that. So it's interesting to scroll through some of these heat maps and look at what people are clicking on. So then I think to myself, maybe I can add something here that would be beneficial to them, because maybe they're wanting to see something that I'm not showing them.
Yeah, to be fair though, I mean, a lot of people, at least for me, for years, Chrome has not consistently shown cursor changes for me. So I'll mouse over something and it won't change my cursor, even if the CSS on it is cursor pointer. So I mean, I don't know if that's a thing for maybe this is just me thing, but I kind of assumed that it was a thing for everybody. So that's something I've been focusing on actually for quite a while now, is making sure that there are really good indicators of whether something is a link beyond the cursor.
Yeah, there should really be some sort of visual indication, I think, from the CSS side. And that's, you know, by default, the browser does that. And what's funny is that a lot of us do things to remove that. We take that away. We remove the underline. We remove the change on hover. We remove the change on click or active. You know, we remove a lot of that stuff, which is not good. And I know that Design Collective specifically can improve a ton there. It's just, I've got, you know, I'm only one camel and I've already got knee braces on. I can only carry so many things, you know? So I don't know. It's, for me, it was really crazy to see, because it made me empathize with the user a lot, because when I would see them do something like that, like they'd miss a click and wait, I would feel bad because it's kind of my fault, you know?
Right. And I mentioned the users kind of getting frustrated with themselves. The fact of the matter is that even if they don't blame your app at all for things like that, it does impact their memory of it and their just overall experience with it. And that's something that kind of, even on a subconscious level, can really damage a user's feelings towards your app or your site.
Totally. But it's been good. I'm trying my best to be data driven. And I know that eventually when we get around to getting a designer, I think the data that I'm collecting now will be the most beneficial to them, you know? So basically they won't have to work off of assumptions, or they don't have to work off of gut feelings. You know, I hear people, or I see people tweeting about like user testing, how it's best to user test early and often. And the session recording is basically just like, you know, a form of user testing.
Yeah. I mean, even with stuff like over the shoulder testing, there are obvious benefits in that you can give someone specific tasks and see them carry it out. But those can be really hard to write. In a way that isn't leading. And I think when you get somebody in a situation where they know that you're specifically trying to get them to help user test an app, you don't always get the most realistic behavior patterns. So I think there's a lot to be said for this kind of real time or real user data.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's other services that do it well. It's just that Hotjar is what I found and it's working. What's crazy though is that I just clicked on, so in the heat map view, you can click on, they separate them by device types. And I just clicked on the tablet one and I noticed that the tablet taps are very, very much more precise. Whereas a desktop, there's clicks everywhere, man. They're just all like in the desert. There's no content near it. There's just a click there, a few clicks there. The tablet one, I've noticed they're like very much more precise, which is interesting. I wonder why that is.
And the pricing on this is actually surprisingly decent, too. They have a free forever basic plan that lets you collect data from 2,000 page views a day. These guys aren't a sponsor or anything. This is just something that Sean's trying out and I've been looking at. But that seems like pretty reasonable. Like that's a decent sample size, even like at scale, you could get some pretty good information out of that, I feel like.
Yeah. Even if you can't get every session of the day, you know, you can still get a lot of good information. I mean, you can get a good information from just a few sessions. So it seems worth it. I didn't have to do much. I just plugged in their snippet, their little JS snippet, and away it went. So I don't know. I think it'll be beneficial. And like I said, I'm trying to collect as much data as I can up front. So I'm doing things. I'm making sure to, like, for example, all of our email templates, I'm adding UTM links to that. So that way we have, I'm just trying to fill Google Analytics up as much as I can with relevant data and not just random browsing data. So I'm trying to, you know, even down to like when a sale goes out, you know, it'll have the UTM links that tells us that it came from an email, but it even came from like this specific sale in this specific store. So, you know, for my bosses, that's useful because they can see which stores are bringing in the most people and they can feature those stores. You know, but I think from a designer standpoint down the road too, they can see what places of the site needs help down the road. And it's even down to the context of like, if there's a button on the top of an email versus the bottom of an email, I'm making sure to catalog which button was actually clicked to send that user there. So I'm trying my best to get as much data to know where to spend our time, because I think most of what needs to be done isn't necessarily hard. It's just that I don't have the time to do it. And so I think that if I have this data, I can save myself. I can be more productive. You know, I can kind of weigh what needs to be done the most and, you know, kind of chisel away from the top down.
Sure. I mean, if you don't have the data, then you're just shooting in the dark. If you have the data, then at least you can attempt to make informed decisions about what the most important things to tackle are.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like, I can't remember if we talked about it yet, but I ended up making a huge dent in how much RAM the app was using. Because when it first launched, it was just a juggernaut. It was using like a gig, like 1.8 gigabytes of RAM, which is insane. And I used a couple of targeted searches I was using Scout, and a couple of really like informed targeted changes based off of data knocked the RAM usage from like 1.8 on average down to 500 megabytes.
That shouldn't be possible. That's wow.
It's possible because it happened. Anyhow, you made a game.
I'm making a game. Yes. I suppose I have made it. It is playable. It's not finished though. I am though. That was the most rambly possible way to respond to that. To respond to that sentence.
It was. I don't know. It was just crazy because I was. I don't remember if you sent it to me in the morning. You were just like, oh, by the way. And I was like, excuse me? Like, I was like, what? When did you learn how to do this?
Yeah, I over the last couple of weekends, I actually took the weekend off. And I taught myself how to make VR games in Unity. It's been one of the most fun programming things I've done in forever, maybe all time. It's very, very different than the stuff I'm normally doing. So that's been great.
Well, do you think it's because of like the subject matter, you being more interested in building a game versus a web app, or is it, do you think it's down to like the language that, like you're using C#, right?
Yeah. So Unity allows you to use JavaScript or C#, but I'm just going with C#, because I want it to. And that's actually been a blast. I have a little bit of C# experience from like my first dev job. I was terrible at it. I was absolutely miserable at it. Not a good enough programmer to really grok like anything about programming, first of all. But specifically like what's great about C#. And so working with a language that has all the type checking and, oh my goodness, IntelliSense in Visual Studio is just lovely. What a great thing that is.
Yeah, I actually downloaded it and now I get blasted. You keep telling me I'm subscribed. I just haven't yet. I just get blasted by Unity.
You just click the link. Click the link at the bottom of the email and you'll be unsubscribed.
It seems really awesome though. I loaded it up and it reminded me of just like a 3D editor, which was pretty crazy. But I watched some YouTube videos and it seems really, really cool. So I might have to check that out. The environment level stuff sounds really interesting to me because I've been dabbling in some other languages, mainly Elixir and a little bit of Go. And you can kind of do type checking in Elixir. I can't remember what the technical term is, but I think they're called type specs. But Go is strongly typed. And the benefits you get from a strongly typed language plus a compiled language, I think are really interesting to me right now.
Yeah, it's it makes it so much more feasible to pick something up. And when I say something, I don't just mean language. I also mean like a new library or a new framework. You can just type things and the system just kind of knows what's available to you. It knows what parameters things take. It just knows everything there is, everything that you might want to know. Everything is self-documenting. As long as it's well-written code, it's self-documenting at least. And that is just such a hugely powerful thing, especially when you're getting started. I mean, I've been able to pick up stuff in Unity that Unity and C# that I still would be like, I don't really know how to do this in JavaScript game framework, even though I've had so much more JS experience.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that's really interesting to me, because I've never, you know, my first real programming language was JavaScript. So I had never worked with a strongly typed language, and the only thing I'd ever heard people talk about when they talk about strongly typed languages is, oh, it's so much more work, it slows me down, etc. And I still see a lot of that. Funnily enough, like I'll see people talking about TypeScript, especially because I follow VS Code and they do a lot of stuff with TypeScript. And a lot of people, that's like, they hate on strongly typed languages because it makes maintenance harder, so to speak. Like, that's what they say, or slower or something. But to me, it seems like there's way more benefits than that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely felt that way in the past, I guess, when I had a bit less experience with typing. But as it's something that I've kind of wrapped my head around a little bit more and played with in various languages and various scenarios, I really don't, there's a lot of benefits. there's a lot of benefits and some pretty dang good benefits.
Yeah. It's kind of like the don't tread on me, I don't want your rules to, please help me as much as you can. It's like that. It's like the new kind of, I'm young and I want to build stuff quickly versus I'm jaded now and I need help, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I build stuff faster with Auth. I mean, I'm going back to, you know, obviously I'm still doing a lot of Ruby and JS code for NestNote stuff during the day. And that's, I go to that and it's like, I really miss a lot of the benefits I'm getting from C# and from Visual Studio's lovely, lovely autocomplete.
Yeah. Yeah. That's just kind of like, it's one of those things where I lay in bed and think about stuff at night. I'm like, stupid things like, did I double check that rate task before it sends out 30,000 emails tomorrow? Or am I making the right choice in learning X language? Or I'm just like in agony over some stuff, because agony is maybe a wrong term, but I think about this stuff a lot. Like, I really like Ruby a lot. I like the syntax a lot. It's a beautiful language to use. But I really like the idea of strongly typed language. I really like the idea of something that's a little bit more performant. I really like the idea of a compiled language for if anything else, for IntelliSense, honestly, if I'm being completely honest.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I wouldn't disagree with that.
Anyway. Your game seems really awesome. It's called Microcosm, right?
Yeah, Microcosm. So Microcosm, I'm sure most people know this, but basically a Microcosm is a smaller representation of some larger system. And so this game that I've made it's a VR game where you paint with voxels. A couple of people have said it's sort of like a combination of like if Minecraft met Tilt Brush, I guess. But it's just an idea that I've had for a long time. It's basically kind of what I've wanted to play in VR since I first heard about the Oculus, like forever ago. And like nobody seemed to be making the game that I wanted, and so as is my tendency, after a long enough period, I just said to myself, well, if nobody else is making this thing, I guess I have to learn how to make it if I want to see it in the world. Because I mean, that's how I learned how to program.
Well, I think that's a perfect reason, you know, and I think that's why you're able to power through it so quickly, is because it's something that you wanted to exist.
Right. Yeah, that's always been the only way that I can learn, I mean, basically anything, is by needing to learn it in order to make a thing that I want to see. It's always about the end goal, and I think that's a really important thing, personally.
Yeah, I mean, I in the past, I can completely tell when I'm working on something that I want to exist versus something that I'm just doing for money. And it's like a complete night and day difference, even down to my energy levels while I'm working on something.
Yeah. And then the nice thing about this, though, you mentioned a little bit ago, the worry about oh, have I picked the right path? Is this the right language for me to be learning right now? Is this the right skill set for me to be honing at the moment? And that was something that I have worried about a lot in the past, and I'm trying not to as much anymore, because kind of what I found, and we've touched on this on the show before, of course, but what I've found is that it doesn't really matter what I learn next, because every single time I learn a new thing, it teaches me stuff about the things I already know. Like I learn new perspectives and new ways of thinking about it. So now I'm thinking about types a lot more. I'm thinking about how to optimize data structures a lot more because of the work that I'm doing in this game. And that's something that is already kind of being reflected in my other work, even in completely other languages, even in Ruby, even in JavaScript.
Yeah, I really like that you said optimizing data structures there. And I was actually watching, there's a YouTube video I'll put in the show notes, but it's called Learn Go in one video or something. It's like an hour long, and this dude just blasting through Go. And I noticed that like it was so different in being a strong type language. So when you declare your arrays, you're supposed to declare how many items would be in that array and what types they're supposed to be. And then you could have a thing called a slice, which is kind of, you can have as many things as you want in the array. You don't have to predefine it, but you still have to define the types of the thing. And I just thought to myself, like, wow, you would really have to think about how something should be structured before you built it. And then it dawned on me, like, well, you should probably do that anyway, but I don't in dynamically typed languages, because I don't have to think about it. I'm more just willing to like run and gun and change things as I go, which is not great, because then you're changing lots of things, you're causing bugs, you know? So I think that the idea of using a strong type language simply just to force me to think through my design decisions, it would be a great thing.
Yeah, that's exactly the sort of thing I'm talking about, where it's bringing, obviously I can't bring the same type system that C# has into Ruby. That would be not only infeasible, it would be silly. It would be a bad thing to do. But bringing the same concepts, thinking about, stuff like plain old Ruby objects. You make, at least I find myself making a lot more smaller modular classes and structs and things to just move data around and do small computations on things in C#, because I kind of have to. There's not really an option a lot of the time. You just kind of, it's like, oh, I need a new type of object to do this thing that I need to do. And like you said, I don't do that in Ruby a lot of the time, not because it's a bad idea to do it. It's still actually a really good way to structure things, but I don't do it because I can just skip doing it. I can be lazy about it. And sometimes you don't even realize you're being lazy, or that is laziness, or the bad type of laziness, right? But getting that new perspective from a language that maybe has a language, a technology, a framework, whatever it is, a thing that isn't the thing you get paid for, I think is so valuable for growing as a programmer, and just gives you such valuable insights every time. So I just, all of that to say, I don't think it's really worth worrying about, is this the best possible thing for my career? Because the fact is, technology changes all the time. There's always going to be a new thing to learn, and you're going to need to be keeping up with that stuff if you want to be a professional developer. That is what it is, and that's not changing anytime soon. But learning new stuff, even if it's not the important thing that you need for your career, otherwise you're not going to be successful or whatever you think that is, it doesn't really matter. I would just go learn it. If it's interesting to you, you're going to learn awesome stuff from it that is relevant for your job no matter what.
It's very good advice. Very good advice.
Thanks for tuning in to Does Not Compute. If you enjoy the show, remember to rate or review it in iTunes. It only takes a minute, and it's one of the most effective ways to help other people find out about Does Not Compute. We've got a link directly to the iTunes page in show notes to make it even easier. Thanks so much. Sean and I really appreciate the support.